and then look back for a moment, and then look away again. The pictures get jumbled. You tend to miss a lot, and then afterward, when you go to tell about it, there is always that surreal seemingness which makes the story seem untrue, but which in fact represents the hard and exact truth as it seemed. In many cases, a true war story cannot be believed. If you believe it, be skeptical. It's a question of credibility. Often the crazy stuff is true, and the normal stuff isn't, because the normal stuff is necessary to make you believe the truly incredible craziness. In other cases, you can't even tell a true war story. Sometimes it's just beyond telling. I heard this one, for example, from Mitchell Sanders. It was near dusk, and we were sitting at my foxhole along a wide, muddy river north of Quanggai City. I remember how peaceful the twilight was. A deep pinkish red spilled out on the river, which moved without sound. And in the morning we would cross the river and march west into the mountains. The occasion was right for a good story. "God's truth," Mitchell Sanders said. "A six-man patrol goes up into the mountains on a basic listening post operation. The idea is to spend a week up there, just lie low, and listen for enemy movement. They got a radio along, so if they hear anything suspicious, anything, they're supposed to call in artillery or gunships or whatever it takes. Otherwise, they keep strict field discipline, absolute silence. They just listen." Sanders glanced at me to make sure I had the scenario. He was playing with his yo-yo, dancing it with short, tight strokes of the wrist. His face was blank in the dusk. "We're talking regulation, by the book LP. These six guys, they don't say boo for a solid week. They don't got tongues. All ears." "Right," I said. "Understand me?" "Invisible." Sanders nodded. "Affirm," he said. "Invisible. So what happens is, these guys get themselves deep in the bush, all camouflaged up, and they lie down and they wait, and that's all they do. Nothing else. They lie there for seven straight days and just listen. And man, I'll tell you, it's spooky. This is mountains. You don't know spooky till you've been there. Jungle, sort of. Except it's way up in the clouds and there's always this fog, like rain, except it's not raining. Everything's all wet and swirly and tangled up and you just can't see jack. You can't find your own pecker to piss with. Like you don't even have a body. Serious spooky. You just go with the vapors. The fog sort of takes you in. And the sounds, man, the sounds carry forever. You hear stuff nobody should ever hear." Sanders was quiet for a second, just working the yo-yo. Then he smiled at me. "So, after a couple days, the guys start hearing this real soft, kind of whacked-out music. Weird echoes and stuff, like a radio or something, but it's not a radio. It's this strange gook music that comes right out of the rocks. Far away, sort of, but right up close, too. They try to ignore it, but it's a listening post, right? So they listen. And every night they keep hearing that crazy-ass gook concert, all kinds of chimes and xylophones. I mean, this is wilderness. No way it can be real. But there it is, like the mountains are tuned into Radio fucking Hanoi. Naturally, they get nervous. One guy sticks juicy fruit in his ears. Another guy almost flips. Thing is, though, they can't report music. They can't get on the horn and call back the base and say, 'Hey, listen, we need some firepower. We gotta blow away this weirdo gook rock band.' They can't do that. It wouldn't go down. So they lie there in the fog and they keep their mouths shut. And what makes it extra bad, see, is the poor dudes can't horse around like normal. Can't joke it away. Can't even talk to each other except maybe in whispers. All hush hush, you know? And that just revs up the willies. All they do is listen." Again, there was some silence as Mitchell Sanders looked out on the river. The dark was coming on hard now, and off to the west I could see the mountains rising in silhouette. All the mysteries and unknowns. "This next part," Sanders says quietly, "you won't believe." "Probably not," I said. "No, you won't. And you know why?" He gave me a long, tired smile. because it happened, because every word is absolutely dead on true. Sanders made a sound in his throat, like a sigh, as if to say he didn't care if I believed him or not. But he did care. He wanted me to feel the truth, to believe by the raw force of feeling. He seemed sad in a way. "These six guys," he said, "they're pretty fried out by now. And one night, they start hearing voices, like at a cocktail party. That's what it sounds like, this big swank gook cocktail party somewhere out there in the fog. Music and chit-chat and stuff. It's crazy, I know, but they hear the champagne corks. They hear the actual martini glasses, real hoity-toity, all very civilized, except this isn't civilization. This is Nam. Anyway, the guys try to be cool. They just lie there and groove. But after a while, they start hearing, you won't believe this, they hear chamber music. They hear violins and cellos. They hear this terrific mama-san soprano. Then, after a while, they hear gook opera and a glee club and the Haiphong boys choir and a barbershop quartet and all kinds of funky chanting of Buddha, Buddha stuff. And the whole time, in the background, there's still that cocktail party going on. All these different voices, not human voices, though, because it's the mountains, follow me? The rock, it's talking. And the fog, too. And the grass and the goddamn mongooses, everything talks. The trees talk politics, the monkeys talk religion, the whole country, Vietnam, the place talks. It talks, you understand? Nam, it truly talks. The guys can't cope. They lose it. And they get on the radio and they report enemy movement, a whole army, they say, and they order a firepower. And they get arty and gunships, and they call in airstrikes, and I'll tell you, they fucking crashed that cocktail party all night long. They just smoke these mountains. They make jungle juice. They blow away trees and glee clubs and whatever else there is to blow away. It's scorch time. They walk napalm up and down the ridges. They bring in the Cobras and F-4s. They use Willie, Peter, and H.E. and incendiaries. It's all fire. They make those mountains burn. Around dawn, things finally get quiet, like you never even heard quiet before. One of those real thick, real misty days, just clouds and fog. They're off in this special zone, and the mountains are absolutely dead flat silent. Like Brigadoon, pure vapor, you know? Everything's all sucked up inside the fog. Not a single sound, except they still hear it. So they pack up and start humping. They head down the mountain back to base camp. And when they get there, they don't say diddly. They don't talk. Not a word. Like they're deaf and dumb. Later on, this fat bird colonel comes up and asks, what the hell happened out there? What'd they hear? Why all the ordnance? The man's ragged out. He gets down tight on their case. I mean, they spent $6 trillion on firepower, and this fat-ass colonel wants answers. He wants to know what the fucking story is. But the guys don't say zip. They just look at him for a while, sort of funny-like, sort of amazed, and the whole war is right there in the stare. It says everything you can't say. It says, man, you got wax in your ears. It says, poor bastard, you'll never know. Wrong frequency. You don't even want to hear this. Then they salute the fucker and walk away, because certain stories you don't ever tell. You could tell a true war story by the way it never seems to end. Not then, not ever. Not when Mitchell Sanders stood up and moved off into the dark. It all happened. Even now, at this instant, I remember that yo-yo. In a way, I suppose, you had to be there. You had to hear it. But I could tell how desperately Sanders wanted me to believe him. His frustration at not quite getting the details right, not quite pinning down the final and definitive truth. And I remember sitting at my foxhole that night, watching the shadows of Quang Gai, thinking about the coming day and how we would cross the river and march west into the mountains. All the ways I might die, all the things I did not understand. Late in the night, Mitchell Sanders touched my shoulder. Just came to me, he whispered. The moral, I mean. Nobody listens. Nobody hears nothing. Like that fat-ass colonel. The politicians, all the civilian types, your girlfriend, my girlfriend, everybody's sweet little virgin girlfriend. What they need is to go out on LP. The vapors, man. Trees and rocks. You got to listen to your enemy. And then again, in the morning, Sanders came up to me. The platoon was preparing to move out, checking weapons, going through all the rituals that preceded a day's march. Already the lead squad had crossed the river and was filing off toward the west. "I got a confession to make," Sanders said. "Last night, man, I had to make up a few things." "I know that." "The glee club? There wasn't any glee club."
"Right."
"No opera."
"Forget it. I understand."
"Yeah, but listen, it's still true. Those six guys, they heard wicked sounds out there. They heard sound you just plain won't believe."
Sanders pulled on his rucksack, closed his eyes for a moment, and let out a short, throat-clearing sigh. I knew what was coming. "All right," I said. "What's the moral?"
"Forget it."
"No, go ahead." For a long while, he was quiet, looking away, and the silence kept stretching out until it was almost embarrassing. Then he shrugged and gave me a stare that lasted all day.
"Hear that quiet, man?" he said. "That quiet. Just listen. There's your moral."
In a true war story, if there's a moral at all, it's like the thread that makes the cloth. You can't tease it out. You can't extract the meaning without unraveling the deeper meaning. And in the end, really, there's nothing much to say about a true war story except maybe, oh. True war stories do not generalize. They do not indulge in abstraction or analysis. For example, war is hell. As a moral declaration, the old truism seems perfectly true, and yet, because it abstracts, because it generalizes, I can't believe it with my stomach. Nothing turns inside. It comes down to gut instinct. A true war story, if truly told, makes the stomach believe. This one does it for me. I've told it before, many times, many versions, but here's what actually happened. We crossed that river and marched west into the mountains. On the third day, Kurt Lemon stepped on a booby-trapped 105 round. He was playing catch with Rat Kiley, laughing, and then he was dead. The trees were thick. It took nearly an hour to cut an LZ for the dust off. Later, higher in the mountains, we came across a baby VC water buffalo. What it was doing there, I don't know. No farms, no paddies. But we chased it down and got a rope around it and led it along to a deserted village where we set up for the night. After supper, Rat Kiley went over and stroked its nose. He opened up a can of sea rations, pork and beans, but the baby buffalo wasn't interested. Rat shrugged. He stepped back and shot it through the right front knee. The animal didn't make a sound. It went down hard, then got up again, and Rat took careful aim and shot off an ear. He shot it in the hindquarters and in the little hump at its back. He shot it twice in the flanks. It wasn't to kill, it was to hurt. He put the rifle muzzle up against the mouth and shot the mouth away. Nobody said much. The whole platoon stood there watching, feeling all kinds of things. But there wasn't a great deal of pity for the baby water buffalo. Kurt Lemon was dead. Rat Kiley had lost his best friend in the world. Later in the week, he would write a long personal letter to the guy's sister, who would not write back. But for now, it was a question of pain. He shot off the tail. He shot away chunks of meat below the ribs. All around us, there was the smell of smoke and filth and deep greenery, and the evening was humid and very hot. Rat went to automatic. He shot randomly, almost casually, quick little spurts in the belly and butt. Then he reloaded, squatted down, and shot it in the left front knee. Again, the animal fell hard and tried to get up, but this time it couldn't quite make it. It wobbled and went down sideways. Rat shot it in the nose. He bent forward and whispered something, as if talking to a pet. Then he shot it in the throat. All the while, the baby buffalo was silent, or almost silent, just a light bubbling sound where the nose had been. It lay very still. Nothing moved except the eyes, which were enormous, the pupils shiny, black, and dumb. Rat Kiley was crying. He tried to say something, but then cradled his rifle and went off by himself. The rest of us stood in a ragged circle around the baby buffalo. For a time, no one spoke. We had witnessed something essential, something brand new and profound, a piece of the world so startling there was not yet a name for it. Somebody kicked the baby buffalo. It was alive, though just barely, just in the eyes. "Amazing," Dave Jensen said. "My whole life, I never seen anything like that." "Never?" "Not hardly, not once." Kiowa and Mitchell Sanders picked up the baby buffalo. They hauled it across the open square, hoisted it up, and dumped it in the village well. Afterward, we sat waiting for Rat to get himself together.
"Amazing," Dave Jensen kept saying. "A new wrinkle. I never seen it before."
Mitchell Sanders took out his yo-yo.
"Well, that's Nam," he said. "Garden of Evil. Over here, man, every sin's real fresh and original."
How do you generalize? War is hell. But that's not the half of it. Because war is also mystery and terror and adventure and courage and discovery and holiness and pity and despair and longing and love. War is nasty. War is fun. War is thrilling. War is drudgery. War makes you a man. War makes you dead. The truths are contradictory. It can be argued, for instance, that war is grotesque, but in truth, war is also beauty. For all its horror, you can't help but gape at the awful majesty of combat. You stare out at tracer rounds unwinding through the dark, like brilliant red ribbons. You crouch in ambush as a cool, impassive moon rises over the nighttime paddies. You admire the fluid symmetries of troops on the move, the harmonies of sound and shape and proportion, the great sheets of metal fire streaming down from a gunship, the illumination rounds, the white phosphorus, the purpley-orange glow of napalm, the rocket's red glare. It's not pretty, exactly. It's astonishing. It fills the eye. It commands you. You hate it, yes, but your eyes do not. Like a killer forest fire, like cancer under a microscope, any battle or bombing raid or artillery barrage has an aesthetic purity of absolute moral indifference, a powerful, implacable beauty. And a true war story will tell the truth about this, though the truth is ugly. To generalize about war is like generalizing about peace. Almost everything is true. Almost nothing is true. At its core, perhaps, war is just another name for death. And yet any soldier will tell you, if he tells the truth, that proximity to death brings with it the corresponding proximity to life. After a firefight, there is always the immense pleasure of aliveness. The trees are alive, the grass, the soil, everything. All around you, things are purely living, and you among them. And the aliveness makes you tremble. You feel an intense, out-of-the-skin awareness of your living self, your truest self, the human being you want to be, and then become by the force of wanting it. In the midst of evil, you want to be a good man. You want decency. You want justice and courtesy and human concord, things you never knew you wanted. There is a kind of largeness to it, a kind of godliness. Though it's odd, you're never more alive than when you're almost dead. You recognize what's valuable. Freshly, as if for the first time, you love what's best in yourself and in the world, all that might be lost. At the hour of dusk, you sit at your foxhole and look out on the wide river turning pinkish red, and at the mountains beyond. And although in the morning you must cross the river and go into the mountains and do terrible things and maybe die, even so, you find yourself studying the fine colors of the river. You feel wonder and awe at the setting of the sun, and you are filled with the hard, aching love for how the world could be and always should be, but now is not. Mitchell Sanders was right. For the common soldier, at least, war has the feel, the spiritual texture of a great ghostly fog, thick and permanent. There is no clarity. Everything swirls. The old rules are no longer binding. The old truths no longer true. Right spills over into wrong. Order blends into chaos, love into hate, ugliness into beauty, law into anarchy, civility into savagery. The vapors suck you in. You can't tell where you are or why you're there, and the only certainty is overwhelming ambiguity. In war, you lose your sense of the definite, hence your sense of truth itself. And therefore it's safe to say that in a true war story, nothing is ever absolutely true. Often, in a true war story, there is not even a point, or else the point doesn't hit you until 20 years later, in your sleep. And you wake up and you shake your wife and start telling the story to her. Except when you get to the end, you've forgotten the point again. And then for a long time, you lie there watching the story happen in your head. You listen to your wife's breathing. The war is over. You close your eyes. You take a feeble swipe at the dark and think, Christ, what's the point? This one wakes me up. In the mountains that day, I watched Lemon turn sideways. He laughed and said something to Rat Kiley. Then he took a peculiar half-step, moving from shade into bright sunlight, and the booby-trapped 105 round blew him into the tree. The parts were just hanging there, so Dave Jensen and I were ordered to shimmy up and peel him off. I remember the white bone of an arm. I remember pieces of skin and something wet and yellow that must have been the intestines. The gore was horrible and stays with me. But what wakes me up 20 years later is Dave Jensen singing Lemon Tree as we threw down the parts. You can tell a true war story by the questions you ask. Somebody tells a story, let's say, and afterward you ask, is it true? And if the answer matters, you've got your answer. For example, we've all heard this one. Four guys go down a trail. A grenade sails out. One guy jumps on it and takes the blast and saves his three buddies. Is it true? The answer matters. You'd feel cheated if it never happened. Without the grounding reality, it's just a trite bit of puffery, pure Hollywood. Untrue in the way all such stories are untrue. Yet even if it did happen, and maybe it did, anything's possible. Even then, you know it can't be true, because a true war story does not depend upon that kind of truth. Absolute occurrence is irrelevant. A thing may happen and be a total lie. Another thing may not happen and be truer than the truth. For example, four guys go down a trail. A grenade sails out. One guy jumps on it and takes the blast, but it's a killer grenade, and everybody dies anyway. Before they die, though, one of the dead guys says, "The fuck you do that for?" And the jumper says, "Story of my life, man." And the other guy starts to smile, but he's dead. That's a true story that never happened. 20 years later, I can still see the sunlight on Lemon's face. I can see him turning, looking back at Rat Kiley. Then he laughed and took that curious half-step from shade into sunlight, his face suddenly brown and shining. And when his foot touched down, in that instant, he must have thought it was the sunlight that was killing him. It was not the sunlight. It was a rigged 105 round. But if I could ever get the story right, how the sun seemed to gather around him and pick him up and lift him high into the tree, if I could somehow recreate the fatal whiteness of that light, the quick glare, the obvious cause and effect, then you would believe what the last thing Kurt Lemon believed, which for him must have been the final truth. Now and then, when I tell this story, someone will come up to me afterward and say she liked it. It's always a woman. Usually it's an older woman of kindly temperament and humane politics. She'll explain that as a rule she hates war stories. She can't understand why people want to wallow in all the blood and gore. But this one she liked, the poor baby buffalo, it made her sad. Sometimes, even, there are little tears. What I should do, she'll say, is put it all behind me. Find new stories to tell. I won't say it, but I'll think it. I'll picture Rat Kiley's face, his grief, and I'll think, You dumb coos. Because she wasn't listening. It wasn't a war story. It was a love story. But you can't say that. All you can do is tell it one more time, patiently, adding and subtracting, making up a few things to get at the real truth. No Mitchell Sanders, you tell her. No Lemon, no Rat Kylie, no Trail Junction, no Baby Buffalo, no vines or moss or white blossoms. Beginning to end, you tell her, it's all made up. Every goddamn detail. The mountains and the river, and especially that poor dumb baby buffalo. None of it happened. None of it. And even if it did happen, it didn't happen in the mountains. It happened in this little village on the Batangang Peninsula, and it was raining like crazy. And one night a guy named Stink Harris woke up screaming with a leech on his tongue. You can tell a true war story if you just keep on telling it. And in the end, of course, a true war story is never about war. It's about sunlight. It's about the special way that dawn spreads out on the river when you know you must cross the river and march into the mountains and do things you are afraid to do. It's about love and memory. It's about sorrow. It's about sisters who never write back and people who never listen. The Dentist. When Kurt Lemon was killed, I found it hard to mourn. I knew him only slightly, and what I did know was not impressive. He had a tendency to play the tough soldier role, always posturing, always puffing himself up, and on occasion he took it way too far. It's true that he pulled off some dangerous stunts, even a few that seemed plain crazy, like the time he painted up his body and put on a ghost mask and went out trick-or-treating on Halloween. But afterward, he couldn't stop bragging. He kept replaying his own exploits, tacking on little flourishes that never happened. He had an opinion of himself, I think, that was too high for his own good. Or maybe it was the reverse. Maybe it was a low opinion that he kept trying to erase. In any case, it's easy to get sentimental about the dead. And to guard against that, I want to tell you a quick Kurt Lemon story. In February, we were working an area of operations called the Rocket Pocket, which got its name from the fact that the enemy sometimes used the place to launch rocket attacks on the airfield at Chulai. But for us, it was like a two-week vacation. The AO lay along the South China Sea, where things had the feel of a resort. The white beaches and palm trees and friendly little villages. It was a quiet time. No casualties, no contact at all. As usual, though, the higher-ups couldn't leave well enough alone. And one afternoon, an army dentist was choppered in to check our teeth and do minor repair work. He was a tall, skinny young captain with bad breath. For a half hour, he lectured us on oral hygiene, demonstrating the proper flossing and brushing techniques. Then afterward, he opened up shop in a small field tent, and we all took turns going in for personal exams. At best, it was a very primitive setup. There was a battery-powered drill, a canvas cot, a bucket of seawater for rinsing, a metal suitcase full of the various instruments. It amounted to assembly-line dentistry, quick and impersonal, and the young captain's main concern seemed to be the clock. As we sat waiting, Kurt Lemon began to tense up. He kept fidgeting, playing with his dog tags. Finally, somebody asked what the problem was. And Lemon looked down at his hands and said that back in high school, he had a couple of bad experiences with dentists. Real sadism, he said. Torture chamber stuff. He didn't mind blood or pain. He actually enjoyed combat. But there was something about a dentist that just gave him the creeps. He glanced over at the field tent and said, "No way. Count me out. Nobody messes with these teeth." But a few minutes later, when the dentist called his name, Lemon stood up and walked into the tent. It was over fast. He fainted even before the man touched him. Four of us had to hoist him up and lay him on the cot. When he came to, there was a funny new look on his face, almost sheepish, as if he'd been caught committing some terrible crime. He wouldn't talk to anyone. For the rest of the day, he stayed off by himself, sitting alone under a tree, just staring down at the field tent. He seemed a little dazed. Now and then we could hear him cussing, bawling himself out. Anyone else would have laughed it off, but for Kurt Lemon, It was too much. The embarrassment must have turned a screw in his head. Late that night, he crept down to the dental tent. He switched on a flashlight, woke up the young captain, and told him he had a monster toothache. A killer, he said, just like a nail in his jaw. The dentist couldn't find any problem, but Lemon kept insisting. So the man finally shrugged and shot in the Novocaine and yanked out a perfectly good tooth. There was some pain, no doubt, but in the morning, Kurt Lemon was all smiles. Sweetheart of the Song Trabong. Vietnam was full of strange stories, some improbable, some well beyond that, but the stories that will last forever are those that swirl back and forth across the border between trivia and bedlam, the mad and the mundane. This one keeps returning to me. I heard it from Rat Kiley, who swore up and down to its truth, although in the end, I'll admit, that doesn't amount to much of a warranty. Among the men in Alpha Company, Rat had a reputation for exaggeration and overstatement, a compulsion to rev up the facts. And for most of us, it was a normal procedure to discount 60 or 70% of anything he had to say. If Rat told you, for example, that he'd slept with four girls one night, you could figure it was about a girl and a half. It wasn't a question of deceit, just the opposite. He wanted to heat up the truth, to make it burn so hot that you would feel exactly what he felt. For Rat Kiley, I think, facts were formed by sensation, not the other way around. And when you listened to one of his stories, you'd find yourself performing rapid calculations in your head, subtracting superlatives, figuring the square root of the absolute, and then multiplying by maybe. Still, with this particular story, Rat never backed down. He claimed to have witnessed the incident with his own eyes, and I remember how upset he became one morning when Mitchell Sanders challenged him on its basic premise. "It can't happen," Sanders said. "Nobody ships his honey over to Nam. It don't ring true. I mean, you just can't import your own personal poontang." Rat shook his head. "I saw it, man. I was right there. This guy did it. His girlfriend." "Straight on. It's a fact." Rat's voice squeaked a little. He paused and looked at his hands. "Listen, the guy sends her the money, flies her over, this cute blonde, just a kid, just barely out of high school. She shows up with this suitcase and one of those plastic cosmetic bags, comes right out to the boonies. I swear to God, man, she's got on culottes, white culottes, and this sexy pink sweater. There she is." I remember Mitchell Sanders folding his arms. He looked over at me for a second, not quite grinning, not saying a word, but I could read the amusement in his eyes. Rat saw it, too. "No lie," he muttered. "Culottes." When he first arrived in country before joining Alpha Company, Rat had been assigned to a small medical detachment up in the mountains west of Chu Lai, near the village of Tra Bong, where along with eight other enlisted men, he ran an aid station that provided basic emergency and trauma care. Casualties were flown in by helicopter, stabilized, then shipped out to hospitals in Chu Lai or Da Nang. It was gory work, Rat said, but predictable. Amputations mostly, legs and feet. The area was heavily mined, thick with bouncing Bettys and homemade booby traps. For a medic, though, it was ideal duty, and Rat counted himself lucky. There was plenty of cold beer, three hot meals a day, a tin roof over his head. No humping at all. No officers, either. You could let your hair grow, he said, and you didn't have to polish your boots or snap off salutes or put up with the usual rear echelon nonsense. The highest-ranking NCO was an E6 named Eddie Diamond, whose pleasures ran from dope to Darvon, and except for a rare field inspection, there was no such thing as military discipline. As Rat described it, the compound was situated at the top of a flat-crested hill along the northern outskirts of Tra Bong. At one end was a small dirt helipad. At the other end, in a rough semicircle, the mess hall and medical hooches overlooked a river called the Song Tra Bong. Surrounding the place were tangled rolls of concertina wire, with bunkers and reinforced firing positions at staggered intervals, and base security was provided by a mixed unit of RFs, PFs, and Arvin infantry, which is to say virtually no security at all. As soldiers, the Arvins were useless. The rough and puffs were outright dangerous, and yet, even with decent troops, the place was clearly indefensible. To the north and west, the country rose up in thick walls of wilderness, triple canopy jungle, mountains unfolding into higher mountains, ravines and gorges and fast-moving rivers and waterfalls and exotic butterflies and steep cliffs and smoky little hamlets and great valleys of bamboo and elephant grass. Originally, in the early 1960s, the place had been set up as a special forces outpost. And when Rat Kiley arrived nearly a decade later, a squad of 6 Green Berets still used the compound as a base of operations. The Greenies were not social animals. Animals, Rat said, but far from social. They had their own hooch at the edge of the perimeter, fortified with sandbags and a metal fence, and except for the bare essentials, they avoided contact with the medical detachment. Secretive and suspicious, loners by nature, the 6 Greenies would sometimes vanish for days at a time, or even weeks. Then, late in the night, they would just as magically reappear, moving like shadows through the moonlight, filing in silently from the dense rainforest off to the west. Among the medics, there were jokes about this, but no one asked questions. While the outpost was isolated and vulnerable, Rat said he always felt a curious sense of safety there. Nothing much ever happened. The place was never mortared, never taken under fire, and the war seemed to be somewhere far away. On occasion, when casualties came in, there were quick spurts of activity, but otherwise the days flowed by without incident, a smooth and peaceful time. Most mornings were spent on the volleyball court. In the heat of midday, the men would head for the shade, lazing away the long afternoons, and after sundown, there were movies and card games and sometimes all-night drinking sessions. It was during one of those late nights that Eddie Diamond first brought up the tantalizing possibility. It was an offhand comment, a joke, really. What they should do, Eddie said, was pull some bucks and bring in a few mamasans from Saigon, spice things up. And after a moment, one of the men laughed and said, "Our own little EM club." And somebody else said, "Hey, we pay our fucking dues, don't we?" It was nothing serious, just passing time, playing with the possibilities. And so for a while they tossed the idea around. How could you actually get away with it? No officers or anything, nobody to clamp down. Then they'd drop the subject and move on to cars and baseball. Later in the night, though, a young medic named Mark Fossey kept coming back to the subject. "Look, if you think about it," he said, "it's not that crazy. You could actually do it." "Do what?" Rat said. "You know, bring a girl. I mean, what's the problem?" Rat shrugged. "Nothing. A war." "Well, see, that's the thing," Mark Fossey said. "No war here. You could really do it. A pair of solid brass balls, that's all you need." There was some laughter, and Eddie Diamond told him he'd best strap down his dick. But Fossey just frowned and looked at the ceiling for a while and then went off to write a letter. 6 weeks later, his girlfriend showed up. The way Rat told it, she came in by helicopter along with a daily resupply shipment out of Chulai. A tall, big-boned blonde. At best, Rat said, she was a 17-year-old girl, fresh out of Cleveland Heights Senior High. She had long white legs and blue eyes and a complexion like strawberry ice cream. Very friendly, too. At the helipad that morning, Mark Fossey grinned and put his arm around her and he said, "Guys, this is Mary Ann." The girl seemed tired and somewhat lost, but she smiled. There was a heavy silence. Eddie Diamond, the ranking NCO, made a small motion with his hand, and some of the others murmured a word or two, and they watched Mark Fossey pick up her suitcase and lead her by the arm down to the hooches. For a long while, the men were quiet. "That fucker," somebody finally said. At evening chow, Mark Fossey explained how he'd set it up. Expensive, he admitted, and the logistics were complicated, but it wasn't like going to the moon. Cleveland to Los Angeles, L.A. to Bangkok, Bangkok to Saigon. she'd hopped a C-130 up to Chu Lai and stayed overnight at the USO, and the next morning hooked her ride west with the resupply chopper.
A cinch, Fosse said and gazed down at his pretty girlfriend. Thing is, you just gotta want it enough.
Marianne Bell and Mark Fosse had been sweethearts since grammar school. From the sixth grade on, they had known for a fact that someday they would be married and live in a fine gingerbread house near Lake Erie and have three healthy yellow-haired children and grow old together and no doubt die in each other's arms and be buried in the same walnut casket. That was the plan. They were very much in love, full of dreams. And in an ordinary flow of their lives, the whole scenario might have come true. On that first night, they set up house in one of the bunkers along the perimeter, near the Special Forces hooch. And over the next 2 weeks, they stuck together like a pair of high school steadies. Almost disgusting, Rat said, the way they mooned over each other, always holding hands, always laughing over some private joke. All they needed, he said, were a couple of matching sweaters. But among the medics, there was some envy. This was Vietnam, after all, and Marianne Bell was an attractive girl. Too wide in the shoulders, maybe, but she had terrific legs, a bubbly personality, a happy smile. The men genuinely liked her. Out on the volleyball court, she wore cut-off blue jeans and a black swimsuit top, which the guys appreciated. And in the evenings, she liked to dance to music from Rat's portable tape deck. There was a novelty to it. She was good for morale. At times, she gave off a kind of come-get-me energy, coy and flirtatious, but apparently it never bothered Mark Fosse. In fact, he seemed to enjoy it, just grinning at her because he was so much in love, and because it was the sort of show that a girl would sometimes put on for her boyfriend's entertainment and education. Though she was young, Rat said, Marianne Bell was no timid child. She was curious about things. During her first days in country, she liked to roam around the compound asking questions. What exactly was a trip flare? How did a claymore work? What was behind those scary green mountains to the west? Then she'd squint and listen carefully while somebody filled her in. She had a good quick mind. She paid attention. Often, especially during the hot afternoons, she would spend time with the Arvins out along the perimeter, picking up little phrases of Vietnamese, learning how to cook rice over a can of Sterno, how to eat with her hands. The guys sometimes liked to kid her about it, our own little native, they'd say. But Marianne would just smile and stick her tongue out. I'm here, she'd say. I might as well learn something. The war intrigued her. The land, too, and the mystery. At the beginning of her second week, she began pestering Mark to take her down to the village at the foot of the hill. In a quiet voice, very patiently, he tried to tell her that it was a bad idea, way too dangerous, but Marianne kept after him. She wanted to get a feel for how people lived, what the smells and customs were. It did not impress her that the VC owned the place. Listen, it can't be that bad, she said. They're human beings, aren't they? Like everybody else. Fosse nodded. He loved her. And so in the morning, Rat Kiley and two other medics tagged along as security while Mark and Marianne strolled through the ville like a pair of tourists. If the girl was nervous, she didn't show it. She seemed comfortable and entirely at home. The hostile atmosphere did not seem to register. All morning, Marianne chattered away about how quaint the place was, how she loved the thatched roofs and naked children, the wonderful simplicity of village life. A strange thing to watch, Rat said. This 17-year-old doll with her goddamn culottes, perky and fresh-faced like a cheerleader visiting the opposing team's locker room. Her pretty blue eyes seemed to glow. She couldn't get enough of it. On their way back up to the compound, she stopped for a swim in the Songtrabong, stripping down to her underwear, showing off her legs while Fosse tried to explain to her about things like ambushes and snipers and the stopping power of an AK-47. The guys, though, were impressed. A real tiger, said Eddie Diamond. D-cup guts, trainer bra brains. She'll learn, somebody said. Eddie Diamond gave a solemn nod. There's the scary part. I promise you this girl will most definitely learn. In parts, at least, it was a funny story, and yet to hear Rat Kiley tell it, you'd almost think it was intended as straight tragedy. He never smiled, not even at the crazy stuff. There was always a dark, far-off look in his eyes, a kind of sadness, as if he were troubled by something sliding beneath the story's surface. Whenever we laughed, I remember, he'd sigh and wait it out. But the one thing he could not tolerate was disbelief. He'd get edgy if someone questioned one of the details. "She wasn't dumb," he'd snap. "I never said that. Young, that's all I said. Like you and me. A girl, that's the only difference. And I'll tell you something, it didn't amount to jack. I mean, when we first got here, all of us, we were real young and innocent, full of romantic bullshit, but we learned pretty damn quick. And so did Marianne." Rat would peer down at his hands, silent and thoughtful. After a moment, his voice would flatten out. "You don't believe it?" he'd say. "Fine with me, but you don't know human nature. You don't know Nam." Then he'd tell us to listen up. "A good, sharp mind," Rat said. True, she could be silly sometimes, but she picked up on things fast. And at the end of the second week, when four casualties came in, Marianne wasn't afraid to get her hands bloody. At times, in fact, she seemed fascinated by it. Not the gore so much, but the adrenaline buzz that went with the job, that quick hot rush in your veins when the choppers settled down and you had to do things fast and right. No time for sorting through options, no thinking at all. You just stuck your hands in and started plugging up holes. She was quiet and steady. She didn't back off from the ugly cases. Over the next day or two, as more casualties trickled in, she learned how to clip an artery and pump up a plastic splint and shoot in morphine. In times of action, her face took on a sudden new composure, almost serene, the fuzzy blue eyes narrowing into a tight, intelligent focus. Mark Fossey would grin at this. He was proud, yes, but also amazed. A different person, it seemed, and he wasn't so sure what to make of it. Other things, too. The way she quickly fell into the habits of the bush. No cosmetics, no fingernail filing. She stopped wearing jewelry, cut her hair short, and wrapped it in a dark green bandana. Hygiene became a matter of small consequence. In her second week, Eddie Diamond taught her how to disassemble an M16, how the various parts worked, and from there, it was a natural progression to learning how to use the weapon. For hours at a time, she plucked away at sea ration cans, a bit unsure of herself. But as it turned out, she had a real knack for it. There was a new confidence in her voice, a new authority in the way she carried herself. In many ways, she remained naive and immature, still a kid. But Cleveland Heights now seemed very far away. Once or twice, gently, Mark Fossey suggested that it might be time to think about heading home. But Marianne laughed and told him to forget it. "Everything I want," she said, "is right here." She stroked his arm and then kissed him. On one level, things remained the same between them. They slept together. They held hands and made plans after the war. But now there was a new imprecision in the way Marianne expressed her thoughts on certain subjects. Not necessarily three kids, she'd say. Not necessarily a house on Lake Erie.
"Naturally, we'll still get married," she'd tell him. "But it doesn't have to be right away. Maybe travel first, maybe live together. Just test it out, you know."
Mark Fossey would nod at this, even smile and agree. But it made him feel uncomfortable. He couldn't pin it down. Her body seemed foreign somehow, too stiff in some places, too firm where the softness used to be. The bubbliness was gone, the nervous giggling, too. When she laughed now, which was rare, it was only when something struck her as truly funny. Her voice seemed to reorganize itself at a lower pitch. In the evenings while the men played cards, she would sometimes fall into long, elastic silences, her eyes fixed on the dark, her arms folded, her foot tapping out a coded message against the floor. When Fossey asked about it one evening, Marianne looked at him for a long moment and then shrugged.
"It's nothing," she said. "Really, nothing. To tell the truth, I've never been happier in my whole life. Never."
Twice, though, she came in late at night. Very late. And then finally she did not come in at all. Rat Kiley heard about it from Fossey himself. Before dawn one morning, the kid shook him awake. He was in bad shape. His voice seemed hollow and stuffed up, nasal-sounding, as if he had a bad cold. He held a flashlight in his hand, clicking it on and off. Marianne, he whispered. I can't find her.
Rat sat up and rubbed his face. Even in the dim light, it was clear that the boy was in trouble. There were dark smudges under his eyes, the frayed edges of somebody who hadn't slept in a while.
Gone, Fossey said. Rat, listen, she's sleeping with somebody. Last night, she didn't even... I don't know what to do.
Abruptly, then, Fossey seemed to collapse. He squatted down, rocking on his heels, still clutching the flashlight. Just a boy, 18 years old, tall and blonde, a gifted athlete. A nice kid, too, polite and good-hearted, although for a moment none of it seemed to be serving him well. He kept clicking the flashlight on and off.
All right, start at the start, Rat said. Nice and slow. Sleeping with who?
I don't know who. Eddie Diamond.
Eddie?
Has to be. The guy's always there, always hanging on her.
Rat shook his head.
Man, I don't know. I can't say it strikes a note. Not with Eddie.
Yes, but he's...
Easy does it, Rat said. He reached out and tapped the boy's shoulder. Why not just check some bunks? We got 9 guys. You and me, that's 2. So there's 7 possibilities. Do a quick body count.
Fossey hesitated.
But it can't... If she's there, I mean, if she's with somebody...
Oh, Christ.
Rat pushed himself up. He took the flashlight, muttered something, and moved down to the far end of the hooch. For privacy, the men had rigged up curtained walls around their cots, small makeshift bedrooms, and in the dark, Rat went quickly from room to room, using the flashlight to pluck out the faces. Eddie Diamond slept a hard, deep sleep. The others, too. To be sure, though, Rat checked once more very carefully, then he reported back to Fossey.
All accounted for. No extras.
Eddie?
Darvon Dreams.
Rat switched off the flashlight and tried to think it out.
Maybe she just... I don't know. Maybe she camped out tonight, under the stars or something. You searched the compound?
Sure I did.
Well, come on, Rat said. One more time.
Outside, the soft violet light was spreading out across the eastern hillsides. 2 or 3 Arvin soldiers had built their breakfast fires, but the place was mostly quiet and unmoving. They tried the helipad first, then the mess hall and the supply hooches, then they walked the entire 600 meters of perimeter.
Okay, Rat finally said. We got a problem.
When he first told the story, Rat stopped there and looked at Mitchell Sanders for a time.
So, what's your vote? Where was she?
The Greenies, Sanders said.
Yeah?
Sanders gave him a savvy little smirk.
No other option. That stuff about the special forces, how they used the place as a base of operations, how they'd glide in and out, all that had to be for a reason. That's how stories work, man.
All right, sure. The Greenies. But it's not what Fossey thought. She wasn't sleeping with any of them. At least not exactly. I mean, in a way, she was sleeping with all of them, more or less, except it wasn't sex or anything. They was just lying together, so to speak. Marianne in these 6 grungy, weirded-out green berets.
Lying down? Sanders said.
You got it.
Lying down how?
Rat smiled. Ambush. All night long, man. Marianne's out on fucking ambush. Just after sunrise, Rat said she came trooping in through the wire, tired-looking but cheerful, as she dropped her gear and gave Mark Fossey a brisk hug. The 6 green berets did not speak. One of them nodded at her, and the others gave Fossey a long stare. Then they filed off to their hooch at the edge of the compound.
Please, she said. Not a word.
Fossey took a half step forward and hesitated. It was as though he had trouble recognizing her. She wore a bush hat and filthy green fatigues. She carried the standard M16 automatic assault rifle. Her face was black with charcoal. Marianne handed him the weapon.
I'm exhausted, she said. We'll talk later.
She glanced over at the special forces area, then turned and walked quickly across the compound toward her own bunker. Fossey stood still for a few seconds, a little dazed, it seemed.
After a moment, though, he set his jaw and went after her with a hard, fast stride.
"Not later," he yelled. "Now!"
What happened between them, Rat said, nobody ever knew for sure. But in the mess hall that evening, it was clear that an accommodation had been reached. Or more likely, he said, it was a case of setting down some new rules. Marianne's hair was freshly shampooed. She wore a white blouse, a navy blue skirt, a pair of plain black flats. Over dinner, she kept her eyes down, poking at her food, subdued to the point of silence. Eddie Diamond and some of the others tried to nudge her into talking about the ambush. What was the feeling out there? What exactly did she see and hear? But the question seemed to give her trouble. Nervously, she looked across the table at Fosse. She'd wait a moment, as if to receive some sort of clearance. Then she'd bow her head and mumble out a vague word or two. There were no real answers. Mark Fosse, too, had little to say.
"Nobody's business," he told Rat that night. "One thing for sure, there won't be any more ambushes, no more late nights."
"You laid down the law?"
"Compromise," Fosse said. "I'll put it this way. We're officially engaged."
Rat nodded cautiously.
"Well, hey, she'll make a sweet bride," he said. "Combat ready."
Over the next several days, there was a strained, tightly wound quality to the way they treated each other, a rigid correctness that was enforced by repetitive acts of willpower. To look at them from a distance, Rat said, you would think they were the happiest two people on the planet. They spent the long afternoon sunbathing together, stretched out side by side on top of their bunker, or playing backgammon in the shade of a giant palm tree, or just sitting quietly. A model of togetherness, it seemed. And yet, at close range, their faces showed the tension. Too polite, too thoughtful. Mark Fosse tried to keep up a self-assured pose, as if nothing had ever come between them, or ever could. But there was a fragility to it, something tentative and false. If Marianne happened to move a few steps away from him, even briefly, he'd tighten up and force himself not to watch her. But then a moment later, he'd be watching. In the presence of others, at least, they kept on their masks. Over meals, they talk about plans for a huge wedding in Cleveland Heights, a two-day bash, lots of flowers, and yet even their smiles seemed too intense. They were too quick with their banter. They held hands as if afraid to let go. It had to end, and eventually it did. Near the end of the third week, Fosse began making arrangements to send her home. At first, Rat said, Marianne seemed to accept it, but then after a day or two, she fell into a restless gloom, sitting off by herself at the compound's perimeter. Shoulders hunched, her blue eyes opaque, she seemed to disappear inside herself. A couple of times, Fosse approached her and tried to talk it out, but Marianne just stared out at the dark green mountains to the west. The wilderness seemed to draw her in, a haunted look, Rat said. Partly terror, partly rapture. It was as if she had come up on the edge of something, as if she were caught in the no-man's land between Cleveland Heights and deep jungle. 17 years old, just a child, blonde and innocent. But then weren't they all? The next morning she was gone. The 6 greenies were gone, too. In a way, Rat said, poor Fosse expected it, or something like it, but that didn't help much with the pain. The kid couldn't function. The grief took him by the throat and squeezed and would not let go. "Lost," he kept whispering. It was nearly 3 weeks before she returned. But in a sense, she never returned. Not entirely, not all of her. By chance, Rat said, he was awake to see it. A damp, misty night, he couldn't sleep, so he had gone outside for a quick smoke. He was just standing there, he said, watching the moon, and then off to the west a column of silhouettes appeared, as if by magic, at the margin of the jungle. At first he didn't recognize her, a small, soft shadow among 6 other shadows. There was no sound, no real substance either. The 7 silhouettes seemed to float across the surface of the earth, like spirits, vaporous and unreal. As he watched, Rat said, it made him think of some freaky opium dream. The silhouettes moved without moving. Silently, one by one, they came up the hill, passed through the wire, and drifted in a loose file across